Good morning. It might not be the end of the world that the Honolulu Zoo lost accreditation, but what's the plan to stabilize funding and stem the parade of zoo directors? We'll talk to City Council member Trevor Ozawa in just a few minutes. Meanwhile, on Maui, a citizens group is pushing for small organic farms created from large commercial ag land. We'll get an update on the Maui County Community Organic Farmland Initiative from founder Bruce Douglas. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. In music, poetry, theater, there's so many stories to tell about life's passages. Joyce Maltby and friends have woven them together in a new show as time goes by. And as sketch comedy takes its place among the performing arts, Kimmy Balmilero gives us a preview of the second annual Hawaii Sketch Comedy Festival.
It's Monday, March 28th. This is The Conversation. Next, the news.
Time we could be walking around a zoo with the sun shining down over me and you, and there'll be love in the bodies of the elephants too. And I'll put my hands over your eyes, but you'll peek through, and there'll be sun, sun, sun all over our bodies. And sun.
Oh, I love our crew. Good morning. Bet you can guess what we're going to talk about next, Chris Vandercook.
I can indeed, because there's been a lot of concern about the loss of accreditation for the zoo, yeah?
That's right, and we're going to take a look at that this morning on The Conversation. Good morning, I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Now, you know that money is often at the heart of woes for city agencies, and that reason showed up again last week when the Honolulu Zoo failed to win accreditation from the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. The lack of consistent funding coupled with high turnover in management means that the zoo might have to wait or will have to wait a year before it can again attempt accreditation. So meanwhile, what's the plan? Honolulu City Council member Trevor Ozawa is the chair of the Executive Matters and Legal Affairs Committee. He joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
We've all, you know, been listening to the reports and all saying the same thing. Okay, these are the reasons why: lack of consistent funding, high turnover at the zoo director or in the zoo director position. But this also speaks to a deeper issue of how the zoo itself is structured and what's been happening on various levels, including at the city council, where you introduced a bill that was passed last year that would allow it to have sponsorship for major exhibits. What's been happening with that, that it's not helping the situation with consistent funding?
Well, nothing's been happening on the administration side. You're right. After the bill that I introduced was passed, allowing for zoo sponsorships, the mayor signed it into law, and now it's been probably at least 6 or 7 months since that bill has become a law. The Department of Enterprise Services was supposed to adopt administrative rules to get that program going, but I feel as if there hasn't been a sense of urgency. I visited the Woodland Park Zoo in Seattle in September, beginning of October, and I brought back actually zoo sponsorship rules and regulations that we could use and model our program after here. And since then, nothing has happened. I just feel like there's no sense of urgency, like I said. And I think this lack of accreditation now will light a fire under the department to get it going.
Often we see similar situations where something will fall on deaf ears and then there's a problem, and then the problem all of a sudden begins to be the reason for trying to shape change, that we always live in this level of crisis management. The way around that, though, might be a different structure, perhaps.
Right. I think there could be a different structure, corporate structure of the zoo, potentially. But I want to go back. I want to just say that, you know, when I brought back those rules, I believe that the administration thought that we were going to pass accreditation. And I was just preparing for the worst. But also, I thought that it could help us pass accreditation if they saw that we did have a zoo sponsorship program that was thriving prior to their inspection of the zoo in November. So I gave them some adequate time to get things going, and I thought that would help. Now, you said another structure, and I couldn't agree more. Perhaps we need to have somebody in addition to the zoo director there helping out, maybe a chief operating officer of some sort, to really look at the business side of the zoo and how we're getting things done. Currently, the zoo falls under the Department of Enterprise Services. Department of Enterprise Services was created under Mayor Frank Fossey when he restructured the different departments at the city. And everything that fell under Enterprise Services was supposed to be business run, a profit-generating venture. So the Blaisdell, the zoo, et cetera. Currently, I don't think we're there. We have the Department of Enterprise Services director just really focusing on so many things. We got the Blaisdell redevelopment master plan planning. We've got McCoy Pavilion. We've got so many other things that he has to attend to. And then we got the zoo director who's worrying about all the animals and the staff and the projects. I think it's a lot for a couple people to handle.
Well, especially when you're talking about money, it's one of the reasons why most nonprofits have a development director, someone who is out there really looking for the funds for an organization. But that also means that they're, you know, within the nonprofit structure. Are you suggesting that the zoo needs to not only change its management structure, but also change its affiliation as a for-profit entity run by the city?
Well, I think everything's on the table now, or at least it should be. I would like to see some potential ideas of how that structure would work, potentially a private, public-private partnership like they did in Seattle at the Woodland Park Zoo. They were a completely municipal zoo within this last decade, and then they transitioned into a public-private partnership with a lot more autonomy from the city, but still working in partnership with the city of Seattle.
But didn't they become actually a nonprofit, and they sort of were able to get city funding?
Right. So they get exactly. Plus, they also get funding from foundations, Bill and Melinda Gates. There are many wealthy people in Seattle that are also donating, and they're donating through a sponsorship program where they can benefit. They get the tax write off. The zoo gets the money. It's a win-win for them, and that's kind of their donor base. That is the base that really helps them to get going, in addition to the money that they get from the city and the state, and potentially some federal grants as well. So we here at the city are looking at only the operating budget of the city for the Honolulu Zoo, and each year allocating about $6 million, $6 to $7 million. And that's just not working. When I took a tour of the zoo, I just noticed how antiquated it was. And I understand how we need to do more with less in government. But with the zoo, we need to make a determination if we want to have a world-class zoo. If we do, then we can't continue this do more with less. We need to do more with more. And we need to find a way to get more. It's either allocating more through the city, which may be slower, going through this route, or allocating a lot more resources to the nonprofit side and getting the Honolulu Zoo Society better organized or even a lot more organized to the point where they have a huge say in it. Like we were
talking
about.
Well, they're the engine
about.
And
exactly.
Everything else flows from them, which is very different from what we're seeing now. You're
right.
Really asking for a lot of people to adopt the zoo seriously and create funding mechanisms for it because they love the zoo. Sounds like this is going to be very tough, but even with the accreditation issue, which may fall off the news cycle in a little while, does that mean, though, that you are going to have a new initiative for you personally with the zoo?
I'm going to be introducing several new initiatives in the coming months that me and my staff are currently working on to really think outside of the box and also look at other models that work in the mainland that have been struggling perhaps in the past, but that are now thriving. And so I can't say exactly what we're going to do, but we have some great ideas that we're really tossing around right now.
Well, we'll look forward to talking to you about some of those ideas as we move into the year. Thanks very much for being here this morning.
Thank you very much.
Council member and attorney Trevor Ozawa represents Council District 4 from Ala Moana to Hawaii Kai. He's the chair of the Executive Matters and Legal Affairs Committee.
It's all happening at the zoo. I
do believe it. I do believe it's true. A light and tumble journey from the east side to the park.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR 2. It's 8:14 and coming up, celebrating the passage of time and the lessons to be learned. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, a fellow who was a comedian, a radio personality, and a sometime TV and movie actor. His heyday in Hawaii was in the 50s and 60s. He was born in Waco, Texas, and served in Pango Pango in the Second World War, where he learned the Samoan language, and he learned it well enough to serve as an interpreter. He fell in love with the Hawaiian Islands during the post-war years and began his local radio career at KPOA AM in 1954. Paradise of the Pacific magazine called him the Jackie Gleason of Hawaii. His calling card was a gift for mimicry. His impersonations of well-known voices like Louis Armstrong, Clark Gable, and Andy Devine were soon supplemented with an array of local accents. He recorded comic songs like I Stay Lost and Kanaka Nui Hotel and landed bit parts in movies including Blue Hawaii, Kona Coast, and The Devil at 4 O'Clock. He had his own TV show on KONA-TV in the 70s, and this morning we're looking for his name. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And as always, the first one to get it right will get the T-shirt.
I'm Michael Morehouse from the Kahala Hotel. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR 2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Show folk form bonds that go deep, born of the experience of getting on stage with a shared goal, feeling the energy from your fellow performers, the kind that takes you beyond anything you might have thought you were capable of. Those are the kind of friends who will be performing with Joyce Maltby in her upcoming show, As Time Goes By, a collection of songs, poems, stories, and dramatic readings that take us through life's stages. She's with us in our studio. Good morning, Joyce.
Good morning, Chris.
Part of this is you being with some good friends on stage, huh?
Yeah. Some go back, like Earl Kingston and Maxine Hong Kingston. Mm-hmm. But Earl and I go back to 1969 when we were in Glenn Cannon's production of Long Day's Journey Into Night. That's when we met. And it was appropriate because the Glenn Cannon Foundation is sponsoring this program.
Yeah.
And then newer friends and a daughter, Shari Lynn, will be singing and several other people.
Joyce, I got to thinking about the kind of friends you make when you do shows together,
right?
Because it's you really are have sort of shared vested interests, don't you?
Oh, yes. It's a team sport.
Yeah,
you can't. Even though I did do a one-woman show, Shirley Valentine, you're not alone. It's a world.
You wouldn't want to be alone doing a one-woman show.
No.
You need those people who got you there, right?
Right. It's the material is part of it. I mean, the material is a world of people that you are. They are so important to be part of your story.
Mm-hmm.
And of course with theater we know there's set designers and
sure.
all the people who help
but no
you.
One's truly alone,
right? But But no, it is a collaborative art, and I think that's one of the things I love about it.
Sure, yeah. Sure. Really, the bonds do go really deep, I think.
Yes, yes, and we feed off of each other too.
Absolutely.
And when you have that, there's nothing that feels more alive than bringing a story or several stories, as this show might be, to life. You feel alive and that connection with each other.
And you've chosen stories that kind of deal with passages or stages of life, right?
Yes.
Youth, middle age.
Well, yes, I have. But my putting together a program like this goes way back to when I was living in Ridgecrest, California, back in 1976, and two other ladies and I put together a show called Celebrating Women, mm-hmm. because it was the 10th anniversary of NOW, the National Organization of Women. And we were finding material from all over the place about women, and we brought song into it. And we collected hours and hours and hours of material. And then from that, when I came back to Hawaii, I did a one-woman show called Ain't I a Woman, mm-hmm. and so much material. So I am in a show like this that I'm going to be doing at Temple Emmanuel on the 17th of April. For a show like this, I've had to choose out of so much. And it does start with the longings of a young girl. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it ends with the wisdom of that same young girl. It starts with Anne Frank. It ends with Anne Frank.
Uh-huh. After some time has passed.
But we go through love and marriage and some pain and struggle and remembrances and parents and children. And the problem of putting it together for me this time was I had to keep putting it in the rejection pile, things I loved.
That's a painful process to leave out, otherwise the show would be 8 hours long.
Exactly.
Right? Well, yes. We've got a couple of samples from the show. One of them you said is from Jules Pfeiffer?
Right. This is from Jules Pfeiffer's show, Hold Me. Oh. And this piece is called, well, you'll hear what it's called by the first line. I talk too much. I mean, I'm quite bright, so it's really very interesting, but nevertheless, I talk too much. You see, already I'm saying more than I should. I mean, men hate it for a woman to blurt out, I'm bright. They really think she's saying I'm brighter than you are. Well, as a matter of fact, that is what I'm saying. I mean, I'm brighter than even the brightest men I know, which is why it is a mistake to talk too much, because, you see, men feel left out. They grow hostile. So when I'm with a man that I'm very attracted to, I make it a point to talk more slowly than I would to my women friends. And I guide him along from insight to insight. And he ends up being terribly impressed with his own brilliance and with mine for being able to keep up with him. And he tells me I am the first woman he's ever met who is as interesting as one of his boyfriends. Now that's love.
And boy, is that ever Jules Pfeiffer, you know, the combination of comedy and that sort of modern psychoanalytic insight into the
right,
into
and of course,
right?
You know, when in 1976, of course, it was very strong in our women's rights section.
Oh yeah,
but you know, hey, where are we? We're 2000. Is this 2016? And it's still appropriate.
Yeah, there's still maybe just a little work to be done. You had another one as well.
Oh, let's see. Here's one. In youth, it was a way I had to do my best to please and change with every passing lad to suit his theories. Now I know the things I know and do the things I do. And if you do not like me so, to hell my love with you. Dorothy Parker.
Boy, that was just equally evocative of Dorothy Parker. And yeah. Interesting, because both of those had the same message.
They do, and
right?
I probably could have chosen something
No, but I mean, I love the thematic link between them, you know, every passing lad.
Right. But then, of course, there's some very serious things included in this. I'm doing monologues from several plays, and there's more poetry, and Earl Kingston and Maxine Hong Kingston, who I think most people know of from her wonderful, wonderful books. And she is going to be reading a section of her book, Chinamen, with Earl. And then some wonderful music to go along with it, wonderful songs. And it promises to be an interesting variety show.
No doubt. Thank you so much, Joyce.
Oh, you're welcome.
Joyce Maltby and friends will perform As Time Goes By on Sunday, April 17th at 2 p.m. in the Sanctuary at Temple Emmanuel in Honolulu. It will include work by William Shakespeare, James Joyce, Charlie Chaplin, Eugene O'Neill, Maxine Hong Kingston. Performers will be Joyce Maltby, Earl Kingston, Maxine Hong Kingston, Shari Lynn, Becky Maltby, Larry Biok, and Don Conover on keyboard.
Moonlight and love songs, never out of date. Hearts full of passion, jealousy and hate.
Veteran Clinton observer Kim Gatto says the Hillary strategy has always been slow and steady wins the race.
Unlike 2008, they were ready for the long game.
It doesn't mean there haven't been real cliffhangers, though, and how the GOP race reminds her of elections in the developing world and the Middle East. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
More and more station members are choosing continuous monthly giving as their preferred way to financially support Hawaii Public Radio and its work. Mahalo for their sustaining memberships to David and Amy Monk of Honolulu, Doug Harrison of Pahoa, and Kathy and Alan Arrowsmith of Mililani. Sustaining membership is steadily lowering the amount of day-to-day operating support needed to be raised over the air. To become a sustaining member at the $10 a month level, call us at 955-882-1 during business hours or go to hawaiipublicradio.org.
One love.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
Will he stay or will he go? The he is Public Utilities Commissioner Mike Chaplin, and with his term expiring in June, it's now the governor's decision to keep him on or appoint someone else. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Bethann.
And, of course, the whole thing that this is backing into is what's going to happen with the Next Era and HECO deal.
Well, the timing is certainly very interesting. It's hard to believe, but it's been 15 months since the PUC has been reviewing the NextEra Energy bid to buy Hawaiian Electric. 80,000 pages nearly have been filed in documents, you know, by the companies, by the agencies, solar and environmental groups and whatnot. And, of course, the final briefs are actually due May 2nd, so there's more to come. But what if, for some reason, the PUC – and remember, there's just 3 members on that commission – what if they can't decide before Mike – Champley's term ends June 30th. What will happen? There will just be left Randy Iwase and Lorraine Akiba. What if they split? Are they deadlocked? So this is the big question as to whether Governor Ige will act on the appointment.
Another question would be how much it would be a politicization of of the process should he be replaced, if Mr. Champley is replaced.
Right, and Ige has been very clear. He opposes the deal. He doesn't think NextEra is in the best interest in terms of our sustainable, renewable energy future. He opposes liquefied natural gas as well. That's something that Hawaiian Electric and NextEra have been open to. So there is concern that if he did make a decision, and by the way, he does have the power by April 4th to send a nominee to the Senate. He hasn't done that. He could also extend Champlain's term. He could name an interim person after the ledges Powell in early May, but he hasn't indicated. But Roz Baker, who chairs the committee that would actually oversee that confirmation, said that she thinks it's best to keep him on board because otherwise you don't want to politicize this thing. I mean, there's already so much politics centering on this very critical decision. I mean, this is really the future of Hawaii's utility, Hawaii's energy needs hinge on this decision. So why replace Mike Champlain now? That's one of the big questions people are asking.
At this point, the governor, I would imagine, isn't saying very much.
No, he's not. He's been mum on that. One wonders what he is going to do. As I said, he does have a couple of options. But think about it. If for some reason he was to appoint someone new before the decision on the next air deal was made, that person would have to get up on speed, not only on those 80,000 pages, but another 4,600 pages of the transcript from the evidentiary hearing. So there'd be a lot to teach someone to get on board.
Which might be a really good reason to keep Mike Champlain on.
And we'll see.
Okay, we'll see what happens with that. Thanks very much. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat and joins us daily for a reality check.
Good morning. I'm Chris Vandercook. It's 8:30, and you're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Talk back about what you hear on the show on our talkback line, which is 808-792-8217. Find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation. Email us talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up, a push for small organic farms on Maui and a festival devoted to sketch comedy after the BBC. Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, these numbers I'm seeing make it look as if diabetes is on its way to being an epidemic, if it isn't already.
Well, talk to some folks now. They feel it's already gotten to that level.
Yeah.
Today we're going to talk about what actually causes diabetes, how much of it is under our lifestyle control, and how much of it really is going to require a lot of medications to treat it.
I'm hoping you're going to tell me that a good deal of it is controllable through the way we live.
Actually, that's very true. You know, and part of what we've seen in the last few years is that as people have gotten more sedentary, as people have not been doing as much activity, eating higher amounts of calories, we've seen the epidemic of diabetes kind of mirror the epidemic of obesity. But now that we're seeing those trends kind of turn around a little bit, we're seeing people who have a decreased amount of obesity. We're also seeing a decreased incidence of diabetes. So we're going to talk about what do you do if you already have the diagnosis? Are there any new emerging treatments for you? And can weight loss really cure it?
So, but I'm thinking there are some success stories out there that we can learn from then, yeah?
There are a lot of success stories. And we're going to talk about some of the latest research being done in diabetes because it's not just all about sugar anymore. There's a whole different area that we're focusing on, looking at the whole entire metabolic picture of the body, including effects on cholesterol and the heart, blood pressure, and kind of putting the whole picture all together.
It really does seem as a lot of modern diseases are kind of our own making in the broadest sense, yeah?
That's definitely true. But, you know, we're still in this situation where, hey, we've made it, but here we are. What do we do to get out of this? And we're really going to focus today on some proactive things people can do if they have borderline sugar, if they do have diabetes, if they're worried about family members with diabetes. We're really going to talk about how you can put all this together because in some cases it takes a village.
I bet. Thanks a lot, Kathy.
All right. Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak, and that's tonight at 5.
On Maui, a citizens' initiative is looking to gather steam. At issue is whether large ag parcels, now owned as commercial enterprises, should instead be used for community food-producing benefits with small, diversified ag organic farms. If the initiative gets enough voter signatures, it could wind up on the November ballot. The group is proposing a law that would create a mechanism to allow Maui County to acquire the land through eminent domain. Although members of the Community Organic Farmland Initiative say they're not specifically targeting the HCNS lands soon to be out of business, that fact is an undeniable force behind the initiative. Joining us now is the organization's spokesperson, Bruce Douglas. Good morning.
Good morning.
At this point, when clearly there have been initiatives in past that have not done well, do you feel like you're up against even more of a wall with this?
It's hard to tell how much of a wall we'll be behind. It could be that A&B might be a willing seller to get out of the farming business and sell the lands to the people. So we don't know quite how much. I don't think it's going to be quite like we faced with the GMO moratorium in Monsanto.
They seem to be, you know, predisposed to that in talking about wanting to possibly, you know, convert it into smaller farms and possibly doing some leases or other ways of being able to use the land more effectively for that. But in terms of doing it as a community initiative and being able to, you know, get the land through a mechanism created through eminent domain, that seems to be a much more proactive step on your part.
It is. In order for farmers to be successful, you have to remediate the soils and bring back the life to the soil again. Right now, after years of glyphosate and atrazine and chemical fertilizers, the soil is dead and lifeless. And to expect a farmer to go out there and be able to grow without first spending a few years remediating the soils doesn't work. That's why it's going to take a community effort in order to bring life back to those soils.
In so doing, though, you're going to have people who are capable of doing it the proper way. We've been told for a long time that engaging younger farmers is difficult. Other younger farmers have said, you know, we're just waiting for the chance. What do you see?
It will be a community-wide effort. First, it'll be some years of soil remediation in order to bring life back. In the meantime, we can start training our farmers and creating infrastructure so that the farmers can be successful with farmer-run cooperatives and the infrastructure, the sales mechanisms, everything they need to be a successful farming operation.
So you see the soil remediation as being a separate issue from actually giving some tenancy to those farms?
Well, in order for a farmer to be successful, you have to give them live soil. Right now, to just say, well, here's a lease, go out, pay us some money, and good luck, ain't going to work. People, you know, without the infrastructure, the soil, you know, the equipment and everything you need in order to be a successful operation.
As you look at the long-term plan for this, what do you see in terms of the phases of it? Clearly, you just talked about the first phase having to remediate the soil, but what do you see in terms of a timeline that might be reasonable?
Well, some of the soil is 2 to 5 years, depending on how aggressively it's worked. You have to grow something on that soil in order to plow it back into the soil again and return to biomass. Actually, sugarcane is not a bad biomass remediator. You can grow it and without pesticides and herbicides and then till it back into the soil for the biomass, and then you can start adding the essential microorganisms, indigenous microorganisms, mycorrhizomes, fungi, everything you need in order to bring life back to the soil again.
If you had your druthers and, you know, and looking at how that soil might be best used, you're talking about small organic farms. What in particular would you like to see happen with Maui and with those parcels? Were they able to be carved up into small organic farms?
Our ultimate goal is to carve them into the smallest pieces of land for the most number of farmers and the most jobs possible. It may be an interim period where we'll have to do some large row cropping of various other crops while we're getting the soils ready and bringing the farmers up and getting the infrastructure. But say 20 years from now, our vision for that would be, you know, highly diversified organic farms actually growing food to feed Maui and Hawaii, not just industrial export crops.
What kind of food in particular? Because we've had conversations in past about, you know, not trying to replicate the things that you might go into a major retailer and be able to find at any given day of a year, but that, you know, bringing back some of the canoe crops, being able to more fully get into our eating systems, some of the things that grow here well, naturally.
Well, obviously the canoe crops is a prime example of that, but actually all the foods that we eat here, you know, go to, we should be supplying all the hotels and all the school systems and have everything locally grown. That would be the beautiful potential, and that's the largest contiguous farmland piece in the Hawaiian Islands and has a mass potential to, in fact, feed all the islands. I think of Oahu that's got very little farmland for their population and what needs they have to support us here in Maui to be able to use that farmland to its highest and best uses.
So as your group has been meeting now for a little while and trying to organize itself well and move this initiative forward, how many people are really in the core group and how many signatures have you been able to gather?
Well, we are just beginning to get our count. We're about 2 weeks into the initiative, and we're just putting out our calls now to get everybody's counts to see how close we are. And we're planning a couple, a big event next a week from today, Monday, the 2nd of August, April 4th in Kihei. And we're planning other events around the island to rev it up. So we managed to get the 10,000 signatures we needed for the first turn-in in 5 weeks of the GMO moratorium. We have a similar amount of time this time, so we expect to be able to achieve our goal again.
And I would imagine that you have a lot of crossover and cross-pollination with that same group that got the original initiatives going.
There's cross-pollination, but there's a lot of fresh blood, people with new interests and who particularly care about the land. So it's great to see a lot of fresh people jumping in. The first one was kind of the groundbreaker to get everybody used to the fire drill and actually taking democracy in our own hands and using that little bit of true democracy we're allowed.
Bruce Douglas, out of curiosity, are these new people, the fresh blood you're talking about, are these people who are newer to Maui or people who have just been politically activated because of the issue?
Most of the people who've been around Maui for a while and really love the Aina and want to see a future, they've made their roots here and they want to see the future that we all envision. I mean, this is a group hallucination of that farmland being a massive, diversified organic farm. And we can't leave that to a corporation with a profit motive to do that. We don't want to see it more industrial agriculture. We want to see it in its highest and best potential.
And what's the next time post for you to see that this is, in fact, moving in the direction that you want it to?
Well, our first turn-in is 10,000 signatures by April 17th. And then after that, we have another 6 weeks to gather our second 10,000. We need 9,202, but, you know, up to 50% of them, you know, are bad and rejected. So we have to get twice that many for the turn-in, and we have two turn-ins to get reach that process. First, we have to get the initial number of 2,200, and then the county takes 45 days to count those numbers, and then we come back again for a second turn-in to make up for the deficiencies.
Well, we'll check back in with you and see how it's going. Thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you for caring. Appreciate it.
Bruce Douglas founded the Community Farmland Council and also co-founded the Shaka Movement, which successfully put forward Maui's first food voter initiative and won. He's a longtime environmental activist and a 20-year resident of Haiku, Maui.
In today's backyard quiz, he was born in Texas but made Hawaii home in the post-Second World War years and became one of the island's most popular entertainers in the 50s and 60s. He mastered an array of local accents and recorded comic songs like I Stay Lost with the Chick Floyd Orchestra. It was a patter song with the Honolulu City map providing the lyrics. He turns up in episodes of the original 5-0, including McGarrett is Missing and Anyone Can Build a Bomb. He started on local radio in the 50s, hosting both music and talk programs, and was described in a trade magazine, Mediascope, as an easygoing conversationalist. At the peak of his career, he was Hawaii's highest-paid entertainer, with radio, television, movies, and popular songs to his name, a career that took Robert Melvin Lucky Luck a long way from his Waco, Texas birthplace. And at 8:44, that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to Talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Kaimuki to Zithala Fort and Hotel South Baratania Waiakamilo.
Hi, good morning. I'm Tony Pasculi from the Hawaii Shakespeare Festival. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Stargazer time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our tiny planet and what we can look for in our dark island skies. As usual, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's going on?
Hey, Dave. It's great to be back. Look out for the planet Jupiter rising early in the afternoon. Also, look out for Mars, which will rise a little bit later at 10:36 p.m. Now, the Moon will be passing through its last quarter phase this week, and so we will see a welcome return to dark skies by week's end.
Now, we have an update on a story that we had a few weeks ago, the European mission to Mars.
That's right. We are returning to the story of the ExoMars spacecraft and its robotic rover, which is due to land on Mars in about 7 months' time. Well, on March the 14th, the ExoMars spacecraft soared into orbit atop a Russian-made rocket. The launch went off without a hitch until the separation of the booster that was to send the probe to Mars. This booster exploded into thousands of fragments shortly after separating from the ExoMars spacecraft. So the booster was basically done.
So some very good timing, it sounds like.
Incredibly. Luckily, ExoMars was a considerable distance away from the booster when it exploded. However, that explosion would have created thousands of pieces of fast-moving space debris. Now, it looks like ExoMars may have got lucky, but we won't know until they test the science instruments in a few weeks' time.
There could be some damage on it, and we just haven't been able to detect it yet.
Yeah, the chances are remote, but they are still there.
And how about the other stuff that flung off of that? Any of that going to come down like a rain of debris on planet Earth?
Now, inevitably, some of this stuff will burn up in orbit, but situations like this create clouds of debris that travel through space for quite a long period of time.
And it only really takes like a screwdriver or a wrench, right? Isn't that big enough to cause a lot of problems?
But when you think about it, it's not so much the size, but the speed.
Mm.
Even a tiny screw traveling through space at 25,000 miles per hour can really ruin your day. Of course, some of this stuff is so small it could be the size of flecks of paint, which means trying to track it from Earth is a real hassle.
The Pan-STARRS on Maui keeps track of the asteroids and larger objects, but what do they do to keep track of the small stuff?
The small stuff is tracked using radar.
Radar in space or radar on the Earth?
This is radar on the Earth.
Wow, keeping track of flecks of paint in space.
That's basically it. Someone's got to keep an eye on it.
Right. Christopher Phillips and another fascinating stargazer. Thank you.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from HTA, a public charter school serving students grades K through 12 on each island, providing each student with the opportunity for a personalized learning plan combining face-to-face and virtual instruction. Learn more at myhta.org.
In sketch comedy, brevity is the soul of wit. A good sketch lasts about 10 minutes or less, takes a familiar idea or situation, and takes it somewhere unexpected, because that's where the funny is. Finding the funny and delivering it is one of the most difficult tasks a performer can face, so comedians need courage, along with plenty of imagination. Both are present in Kimmy Balmanero, who's bringing two nights of sketch comedy to the Holney Museum of Art this week. And she's with us in our studio. Good morning, Kimmy.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
A lot of training goes into doing what seems spontaneous, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, I started, my connection with sketch comedy actually started with improv.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm an actor. I grew up here in Kaneohe doing theater all my life. And when I took my first improv class in San Francisco when I was about 20 years old, I just fell in love with it. And from there, it just led to doing more improv shows in L.A. and New York and then into sketch comedy. And I haven't let go since.
You make a distinction between improv and sketch comedy, because they are different. But what is the difference?
Okay, so the difference is that improv is completely made up, right?
On the spot.
On the spot,
as
yes.
As you're watching.
Yeah, so most audiences might recognize it as the show Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Mm-hmm.
That's improv. And then also, sketch comedy is like Saturday Night Live. So it's scripted, short sketches, topical. You know, it can be as simple as a cowbell joke to as controversial as gun control, you know? So
sure.
It's a wide range of things.
But it does have to have some kind of hook, right? Something that is familiar to you.
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, reality is funny, right? Life is funny. And I think a good sketch or a good comedy sketch will make you think about either issues that are going on in everyday life or even in the world. Mm-hmm. And also just kind of, I don't want to say it does lighten it up, but also kind of just brings it forward, right? Because we can all can relate to laughing and just kind of looking at certain things in a different point of view. So there's a lot, yeah, having a good hook is something that's familiar to people, something that's topical. You know, now that we're in the presidential races, this is a great time to do parody sketches and all that good stuff.
Well, it's sometimes referring to the presidential race gets difficult to distinguish between a comedy sketch
and
nightly news, right?
You're right, yeah. I mean, if you look at it now, you know, we were talking about this earlier, that a lot of shows nowadays are using comedy as a vehicle to get news out there, mm-hmm. right? And nowadays with social media, you know, things like Instagram, YouTube, Facebook even like a simple status update can have a quick joke in it, but also kind of tell us what's going on.
And I think it kind of gives depth to the comedy, and you know, it seems to make it make a successful sketch into something you're likely to remember long after you remember exactly what the jokes were. You know?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, how many times are you just having coffee with a friend and you talk about, oh, remember that joke back, you know, and you can say the tagline, right? That simple hook, mm-hmm. or even just like a physical movement that reminds you of a funny sketch. You know, there's the Debbie Downer. You do a face and you're like, wah, wah, and everyone knows where it's from.
Right.
You say cowbell and everyone like freaks out. And also with good sketches, they last over time. So there could be things from, you know, over 30 years ago that you watch today,
yeah.
and you're like, wow, that's still really good, you know?
And yet, you know, Kimmy, the whole thing of what's funny, I mean, anybody mm-hmm. will tell you that every person has a different perception
of
it, and it's
yeah.
very, it, you know, it's one of the most difficult things in theater. So how do you reliably produce something that you know is going to work?
Well, you know, I think for me, if it makes me laugh, then I'll put it in. But of course, I think about our audience. You know, we're at the Honolulu Museum for our second year in a row. And one of our goals this year is to not only bring back outside performers like from Los Angeles, but also to kind of focus in on the local up and coming writers here.
Mm-hmm.
So to get back to your question of how do I choose, I think just kind of not only asking myself, am I laughing? Why am I laughing? You know, will our audience like this? But also reaching out and asking friends. Every year we also have a submissions committee. So it's not just me looking at these videos. It's writers, a lot of my friends in Los Angeles are looking at it who know what hits really well and why, or maybe why not. So
mm-hmm. there's been an awful lot of good comedy, very specific to life in Hawaii going back mm-hmm. decades now. Yeah.
Yeah. For sure. You know, I'm really excited because, you know, this year we're actually featuring two live shows. So our first show on March 31st, we have our visiting artist. We actually have Sam Brown from IFC's Whitest Kids You Know and a comedy duo, Stink. And then on April 1st, our second night, we're focusing on just local artists. It's called Two Scoops Funny. And I'm really excited because Mountain Apple Company is letting us show a classic Raps Hawaii sketch. And, you know, he's the grandfather of sketch comedy here. You know, I remember watching him when I was little, and I still look at that stuff and go, oh my gosh, it's so good, from the writing to the production to of course his performance. It's classic, and
yeah.
and it's just so wonderful that we have an opportunity right now to not only support up-and-coming artists here in Hawaii, but also maybe they might not be familiar with Replinger, you know, so to kind of bring them back to kind of where it all started.
Such a genius, the guy.
Really, really wonderful.
And he's always, those bits are sort of a good illustration of this, because he's always telling the truth in
mm-hmm.
those bits, right?
Yeah, and you know, that's the thing about comedy. Like, people laugh when we can relate to something. You know, I always say, like, what about Seinfeld? You know, they tease that it was a show about nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's because we all know a Kramer. We all know a Newman, you know what I mean? So reality is funny, and I think it's a really nice release for us to remember that, and especially now in this world, you know, that we can kind of have that moment and giggle together and laugh together.
You know, I think maybe, Kimmy, that recognition that you have of a familiar setting kind of gives you the comfort, if you're in the audience, gives mm-hmm. you sort of permission to relax. It kind of draws you in and allows
absolutely.
You to.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, everyone, we have it right in our title, comedy. So we want you to come in and just let go of everything, you know. It's, what do we say? It's like Saturday Night Live in Hawaii, and we want you to LOL your pants off. So.
And improv, a lot of these sketches, although the sketches are written and, mm-hmm. And rehearsed, a lot of them start as improvisations, don't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, a lot. You know, I did, I was part of a sketch troupe in Los Angeles, and we actually started off as an improv group. And it happens often, especially when you're doing long-form improv, that you come up with these characters and these relationships and these scenes, and then afterwards you go, wow, that would be a really great sketch. You know, and then you meet again, and then you rewrite it, and then there you go.
Well, it'll be fun to see what you and your pals have come up with, Kimmy.
Yeah, we're really, really excited. It's our second year, and we couldn't be more stoked.
Terrific. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
Kimmy Balmalero is the founder and organizer of the second annual Hawaii Sketch Comedy Festival, Thursday and Friday, two different shows at the Honolulu Museum of Arts, Doris Duke Theater.
Each week, From the Top shares the stories and performances of outstanding classically trained musicians ages 8 to 18. HPR is proud to once again bring this national show to our islands for recordings this winter. We want to showcase Hawaii-based talent like Tiffany Chung, who you're listening to here. Send the talented kids you know to hawaiipublicradio.org/events to learn more. From the Top makes all casting decisions.
As I talked a little earlier today about what's happening at the zoo, in fact, they played that song coming out of it, and really trying to figure out how do we go forward, and maybe there needs to be a different structure, which is what I asked Trevor Ozawa, Councilman Ozawa, this morning. Don't know whether that's going to be something that the city will be able to do or not in the near term, but certainly if we're only talking a year away, how do we get more money flowing in there? Perhaps that idea of having more sponsorships.
Yeah, really, it'll likely come down to community support, how much of it and what it amounts to, and can that be seen as very consistent support also?
Well, that's just the whole point, because that can come up and down, but looking at endowments, looking at what structure might be employed that sort of, you know, comes from the nonprofit world, and if, in fact, they need to change how the city zoo is run entirely. We're going to be watching that one and talking about it, too. But for the moment, we're going to say goodbye because, well, it's almost 9 o'clock. And tomorrow we'll be back with you to talk about trauma prevention with Dr. Robert Geffner. He's the president of the Institute on Violence, Abuse, and Trauma.
And we'll look at the art of the art collector.
If you want to be in touch, lots of ways to do it. Probably the best one is the TalkBack line. That's 808-792-8217. Or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Past shows can be found under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you in the morning for more of The Conversation.